Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sapna Merchandani, and I'm appearing on behalf of appellant Marcel Aparicio Soria. Mr. Aparicio Soria respectfully requests that this court hold that his prior conviction for resisting arrest in Maryland categorically does not qualify as a crime of violence under the guidelines because it lacks an element of violent force. Just recently, this court decided United States versus Gomez, which is discussed in the brief at length, so I won't belabor those points. But in that case, the statute, because it could be committed by force or could not be committed by force, but it didn't actually have categories, separate crimes that you could point to and look at, because of that, it was categorically not a crime of violence. I would also like to point your attention to a decision that Judge Wilkinson, you decided just 15 days ago. It's Rangel Castaneda. And in that case, the defendant was arguing that his conviction for a Tennessee aggravated statutory rape did not qualify as a generic statutory rape under the same guideline we have here, the 2L. In that case, he argued that because his conviction depended on an element that required the age of 18 be the age of consent, while the generically statutory crime had an age of 16, it was categorically overbroad. And that was the language that they used, categorically overbroad. So some of the offenses could have been committed upon a victim under the age of 16,
here,
some may not.
What we have is a couple of prior decisions. I think both of them were written by Judge King, which addressed the more specific.
Which cases?
Jenkins and Warlick.
Jenkins and Wardrick.
And I think they're Jenkins and Warlick, and they address the specific situation here, which was the residual clause of ACCA, that the resistance to arrest qualified as a violent felony.
That was a different clause, and that was a different
guideline. It didn't turn on whether the force clause or the residual clause really was at issue. It seemed to indicate those opinions. And there's a relationship, of course, between the residual clause and the force clause. But
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. Actually, James and the cases you mentioned talk. They are analyzing the question of whether or not the conduct presents a serious potential risk of physical injury. In those cases, you look at the ordinary case,
the difference between the residual clause and the force clause in the ACCA, but what I'm saying is you had really the same crime in these cases, and I'm simply afraid, that was just the residual clause, you weren't dealing with the force clause, that we're going to be eroding those two cases which spoke to exactly this crime.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, those cases did not speak exactly to the analysis here. The analysis here is there an element of violent force? Not.
It might be helpful if you have at your fingertips, and I suspect you don't, but maybe you do.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an opinion anywhere in the country in which the same crime was found to qualify under the residual clause, but not under the force clause? See, that would be the home run,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
That would be the home run.
And I'm sure it does exist, and I promise I will file a Rule 28J letter as soon as it comes to my attention.
We'll look for it on Monday.
But the analysis...
Not this afternoon.
But the analysis is very different, and the government filed a 28J letter which highlights the difference in it.
At some point we have to connect with common sense.
No, common sense has a place,
hold on. I know I appreciate that you're very committed to your case, and it's okay if you interrupt me a little bit as long
Sorry.
As I get to come back. But it again, I think it creates riptides in the jurisprudence and confuses and subdivides what is already a very arcane area. This sentencing stuff is very arcane, and you know, if, when somebody looks at it, we'll say, well, what's the common sense of it all? That the circuit has two, Judge King has two cases out there, in Johnson and Warlick, which said that that resisting arrest qualifies as a violent felony under the residual clause of the ACCA. Mm-hmm. But hey, it didn't address the force clause, and so those Judge King's decisions are simply inoperative, and Judge Chasnow was completely wrong. And then the circuit's jurisprudence, I think, becomes a big muddy.
I agree with you that it's arcane, but the statute is written differently than the guideline. Now, the guideline could have included a residual clause. Why it didn't, I have no idea. It only included a force clause and enumerated crimes. Well, the ACCA has force clause, enumerated crimes, and residual clause. That does not exist here. So you can't import the analysis from Wardrick and Jenkins and pretend it applies here, because that's not the question. It's much narrower here.
Not only would we be creating a riptides within the circuit,
I disagree that there would be.
But I honestly think we would be creating a circuit split with the 11th Circuit.
Romo Villalobos? Is that the question?
Yes. The resisting arrests
with violence.
As I understand it, the 11th Circuit held that resisting arrest satisfied the crime of violent enhancement.
Let him finish.
Sorry.
there was nowhere near the degree of the extent of analysis of Florida courts that we actually have from the Maryland courts. And yet the 11th Circuit says it's a crime of violence. So, you know, what I'm concerned about is a little bit of consistency in sentencing, because the guidelines do have as one of their objectives uniformity, and we on the circuit court have as one of our objectives a certain, we try to have a certain consistency in our jurisprudence. I think Judge Chasnow was really trying as hard as a district judge could try to be faithful to what our jurisprudence had said. She read the whole thing.
Now you can say that the Florida statute includes the term violent force. That's not the Maryland statute.
The Florida statute is divided. There's two different statutes. There's resisting arrest with violence, and there's resisting arrest without violence. The government is talking about the statute, which is titled resisting arrest with violence. Our case is the statute, which is resisting arrest without violence. We do not have a case saying that fits any of these. Now, let me also add that Chief Judge Chasnow has since changed her tune. After Gomez, she has been presented with second-degree assault cases where the same question arises: do you apply the categorical or modified to look for force? She has, since Gomez, decided that you have to apply the categorical approach. Other judges in the Maryland District Court have followed suit, Judges Blake, Judge Motz. So that's the consistency.
Let's say you apply the categorical approach, okay, but that doesn't, you know, sometimes you think, well, we apply the categorical approach, the defendant automatically wins, but
no,
that's not.
They don't automatically win. When you apply the categorical approach to second-degree assault, which is what was recently done, and in this case, you look to the elements of the crime. That's it. You don't look beyond for serious potential risk. That's the residual clause. And here we have Nicholas. The Court of Appeals of Maryland held that you only need de minimis force. That's the same situation that exists in the second-degree assault cases that more recently have been held to never categorically qualify as a crime of violence.
Well, doesn't the Rich decision say force is necessary?
Said force is necessary, and then Nicholas said de minimis force.
The further inquiry is the amount of force.
The amount of force is important because Johnson, the Supreme Court, looked at battery, Florida battery, and found that the battery conviction needed only de minimis force. It did not qualify.
The amount of force is determinative, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is.
You As can't an have, element of the offense.
You so can't have something less.
Look to the facts to determine the amount of force?
No. You look, because the categorical approach makes you have to look at how it is
look
defined.
At the charging document.
That's only if you go to the modified, and that is only if you have divisible categories of crimes.
You're saying this is a category.
This is a categorical, clearly categorical. If you want to go to the modified, we still win because the charging document doesn't tell you that violent, doesn't necessarily show that he was convicted for a violent crime. He was sentenced to 4 days on for what seemed like this spree of activity, and the charging document says he failed to put his hands behind his back, and he hit and he bit an officer. We agree that hitting and biting is violent force, but we don't know which basis he pled guilty to because the government has not satisfied their burden of producing the plea transcript.
The Rich decision, the one line that it draws, it takes about as comprehensive a survey as is possible to take and say that the difference between resisting arrest and the lesser obstruction is the element or the presence of force.
Force, but not violent force.
Well,
Johnson, the Supreme Court Johnson said you have to use.
Let him finish.
Sorry.
All I'm saying is that when you codify a crime, codify it against a common law background, and the background here, dating back from 1950, is that the application of force and not simple flight is necessary for resisting arrest conviction. It makes plain that it simply does not consist of mere flight.
That's right.
And once again, I think when you try to put this together, the circuit precedent is simply very critical to this. And it just seems odd to me, as a matter of common sense, that something can be one thing under a residual clause, something else under a force clause, in the face of a decision, a long line of decisions from the Maryland court that Rich surveys, which says that the difference between arresting or resisting arrest and obstruction is force. I mean, it seems to me we cut against the grain of Rich, and we cut against the grain of our own circuit decisions, and we keep splitting and subdividing and making the whole area more complicated, more arcane. And I also think when you say, "Oh well, resisting arrest doesn't involve force," when the whole crime is called resisting, I don't know how that connects with common sense.
Well, common sense doesn't. What matters is how the Court of Appeals in Maryland defines it. Now, the government keeps talking about resisting arrest being inherently violent. In their mind, they see violence. You may too. In my mind, I picture passive resistance. I picture Gandhi. I picture civil disobedience. But what's in our minds is not relevant. What matters is what the Court of Appeals in Maryland has said. And they said the slightest physical touch, constitutes force. It does not have to be violent.
Pushing away from a police officer and running away would satisfy the elements.
Pulling your arms into your chest is what happened in Jason Allen. Pulling his arms into his chest was sufficient force to satisfy.
The point is, Johnson says you're not to take outliers. And the question is, what do most of these crimes involve? And Johnson says, all right, you can always find an outlier somewhere where there's, and I guess in some of those cases where it was de minimis force, I thought one of those cases in Maryland appellate court actually reversed. But the point is, what is the heartland of the crime? Not whether you can point to some case on the, where you do this and you get, that's not the common crime.
When you're looking, I think your reference to the Johnson language of ordinary case, again, that goes back to the residual clause. They say, let me just quote, it says that the residual provision speaks in terms of potential risk, which is inherently a probabilistic concept. Therefore, the proper inquiry is whether in the ordinary case it presents serious risk. None of that exists in the force clause. Gomez says the only question, much simpler, is there an element of violent force? Here, the answer is no.
You run into Rich, which says that force is an element.
Not violent force. My time is up. I will sit down. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honor. Paul Nitz on behalf of the United States. May it please the court. Judge Chazanow, in July of last year...
Mr. Nitz, this is one of the finest briefs I've read.
Oh.
This government brief. I really mean that. And I always intended to say that to you, but the proof is in Judge Wilkinson's colloquy with your sister counsel. You have used the term violent or violence interchangeably with force throughout this brief. And Judge Wilkinson seems to be persuaded. But you're going to have to do a little more work to persuade me that in the context of the Maryland resisting arrest statute, as interpreted by the Maryland courts, those terms, violence and violent on the one hand, and force on the other hand, really can be used interchangeably in light of the guideline here. So that would be helpful.
Judge Davis, thank you for your very kind comments. And I'm not at all surprised that Your Honor has a few questions for me. Just to see if I can bridge that gap. Let me say that violence is not a magic word here. If violence is a magic word, it's my position that the government wins because the Rich Court says that the character of resisting arrest is, quote, violent and forceful. And so,
but they didn't say that about the Maryland statute. We didn't say that about the Maryland statute.
Well, that is, in Rich, the court says, resisting arrest has never consisted simply of flight or actions that did not amount to resistance by force. And then goes on to say...
The Maryland Court of Appeals says that's not true. The Maryland Court of Special Appeals says you can, in fact, commit resisting arrest without the use of violent force.
Well, and respectfully...
Perfectly clear.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. The question, and I'm sure Your Honor, if I'm reading the question right, is referring to the Nicholas decision, in which the court is presented with a different question.
I'm referring to both the statute and the interpretations of it. Now, I appreciate that you've collected and done a very good job of collecting more than a score of resisting arrest reported opinions that clearly involve force, violent force. And one would expect that the prosecutors around Maryland wouldn't be prosecuting people for resisting arrest. In fact, in this case, in this very case, the most striking question is why they permitted the defendant to plead to resisting arrest rather than assault on a police officer. He bit the guy.
Well,
he bit the guy. Now, you and I both know the answer to that. It has to do with the nature of the Maryland criminal justice system, plea bargaining, under-resourced prosecutors, yada, yada, yada. We all know that, but that's not part of this record. The fact of the matter is, Maryland had the option to convict this guy of a very serious second-degree assault. It may well be first-degree assault, biting a police officer. But they didn't do that. They let him plead to resisting arrest, which under Maryland law includes shoving away a police officer in order to run away.
If I might, I was a local DA for 3 years.
Of course you were.
And I prosecuted resisting arrest. And
exactly.
I had 150 misdemeanor cases on my
exactly, on
my shelf.
And you had to move the cases through.
You got to get rid of them.
And if somebody was willing to plead to resisting and your police officer was still out on the street or homesick or visiting his wife in the hospital, you took what you could get.
And that's right, Your Honor. But in this case, I would point the court's attention to the fact that, as I understand it, Mr. Aparicio Soria was charged with second-degree assault and resisting arrest.
Exactly. And the prosecutor didn't insist that he plead to second-degree assault.
But, Your Honor, second-degree assault is a lesser-included crime
but
of resisting arrest.
But he's not convicted of second-degree assault.
But Your Honor, resisting arrest is, my reading of Nicholas is that second-degree assault, because it meets the required elements test, is completely subsumed by resisting arrest. And therefore...
I think it's exactly the opposite. The opposite. Resisting arrest is the lesser included.
Well, resisting arrest can't be a lesser included of second-degree assault because resisting arrest requires elements...
Well, you need a police officer. Yeah, okay.
Let me ask you this. What significance do you attach to the actual wording of these statutes in terms of the crime of violence and says... any other offense under state, federal, state, or local law that has an element of attempted threat of use of physical force. And then you go to the ACCA, and it says that even the force clause says has an element the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force. They don't use the word violent force. Now, we're talking about a crime of violence, but when you get down to the specifics of it, both the guidelines and the ACCA force clause talk about the use of physical force. So does that make a difference to you that the term physical force is used rather than violent force? We assume that Congress chooses its words carefully, and Maryland legislature for that matter, or whatever.
Well, Your Honor, in questioning for the appellant, used the term common sense, and I would certainly like to put on the mantle of common sense. And in that sense, yes, it does matter that the word force is naked in the definition in both the ACCA and the 2L1.2 guideline, which is what we're here on today. And
even after the Supreme Court has told us what the meaning of force is?
No, Your Honor, we are bound by the Supreme Court's opinion in Johnson. But just to, again, see if I can keep that common sense mantle on, what was the court concerned with in Johnson? The court was concerned with not sweeping in offenses that are predicated on a mere offensive touching. And this is where it's really important to contrast the jurisprudence of the Maryland state courts with regard to second-degree assault and their resisting arrest jurisprudence. With regard to second-degree assault, we have real cases like Lamb and Epps in which a person was convicted of second-degree assault in Maryland for something that was certainly not violent force, like pinching or kissing or brushing up against someone, some other form of contact which meets the elements of second-degree assault, and here we're talking about the battery variety of second-degree assault, but is clearly not violent. And that's what the Supreme Court is after in Johnson. They're saying, you know, the ACCA is not intended to sweep in these state assault and battery convictions that are just offensive touching. Resisting arrest, both when as characterized by the Maryland courts and just as one thinks about the offense in terms of common sense, involves violent physical force. And there's a clause in the Johnson opinion which refers to not violent physical force, but merely strong physical force. Those are the words that are used by the Supreme Court in Johnson. And what we have with resisting arrest, by its very nature, is a crime in which a defendant is trying as best as he or she can to get away from a law enforcement officer. And that means that one human body is trying to escape the reach of another human body. This is not about kissing someone on the cheek or pinching them. This is about someone getting as far away as they can from a law enforcement officer in order to avoid arrest. And that means that what we're necessarily talking about here is strong physical force, because one person cannot evade the arrest of another person except by using strong force. And with all due respect to opposing counsel, they use examples involving someone grabbing a tree or linking arms with protesters. Pulling someone away from a tree is not resisting arrest in Maryland. Resisting arrest in Maryland requires the application of force to another person. And I may have, in fact, said in the government's brief that it requires the application of force to a law enforcement officer.
I guess, just as an overall matter, at some point the law has to connect with a certain degree of common sense, and I indicated that the core elements of resisting arrest are, of course, the application of force, and that's what resisting means. And, you know, when you say, well, what is this crime about? And you don't take a look at an outlier, but you take a look at the kind of crimes that are being prosecuted here. And what you have here is someone who risked serious injury to law enforcement officers, the general public, himself. He engages in a high-speed car chase. His vehicle hits an innocent bystander. He flees into a hotel lobby. There's a confrontation with the police at that point. He's biting the hand of one officer. He's actively fighting arrest until he is, after quite a struggle, subdued. And, you know, and yet Wick, in the face of all this, we're going to split hairs between this, that, the force clause, the residual clause, and whether it's physical force or violent force or whatever. At a certain point, it troubles me because the law has takes such leave of what the common sense of it is all about. It's just like Peter Pan and Wendy over in some never, never land or something to say that resisting arrest doesn't involve force, and generally as a core matter, as a generic matter, very serious force.
Well,
and you know, and I'm certain that's what those opinions in Johnson and Warlick are getting at. And to subdivide this area and to make it more and more abstruse, more and more arcane, and more divorced from the reality on the ground, I just don't see it.
Well, Your Honor is certainly singing my tune in that regard. You know, Judge Chazanow in her sentencing record in this case.
What would the Maryland judges say to Judge Wilkinson in response to that speech? What would the Maryland prosecutors say to Judge Wilkinson in response to that speech? Here's what they would say. Judge Wilkinson, you got a problem in federal court. That's not our problem. Our problem is masses of cases coming through the state system. We've got the statement of charges. The judge who sentenced this guy knew what he did. We don't care if he pleads guilty to resisting arrest or second-degree assault or attempted murder. That's not our problem. Congress made it your problem, Fourth Circuit, by enacting these statutes that incorporate all manner of state law crimes that are just innumerable in their elements, in their context, and that's not our problem.
And
Congress created the problem. The Supreme Court has made efforts to mitigate it, and courts like this one all around the country for years now have made efforts to mitigate it. Judge Wilkinson, as counsel mentioned, wrote an opinion 2 weeks ago that greatly mitigated some of this chaos. But the chaos comes from Congress. And if Maryland wants to permit a guy who bites a police officer to plead to resisting arrest rather than second-degree assault, Maryland's entitled to do that. It's not the role of this court to treat him as if he committed second-degree assault, even if he did, if he wasn't convicted of second-degree assault. That's what the prosecutors and judges in Maryland would say in response to what you just heard.
Well, we are in an area of the law where there is a certain lack of clarity, Your Honor, and Your Honor has laid blame with Congress, which of course has not seen...
But they're not here to defend themselves.
they're not. Senator Spector and Leahy and the other members of the Senate Judiciary Committee who wrote this
law... Senator Spector is not here.
He is not here. They are not here, and of course, Your Honor is right that we've now seen about 25 years since the ACCA was passed, and nary a word has emerged from Congress to amend the statute. On the other hand, Your Honor, I would say that the Supreme Court has been less than crystal clear in this area.
What did Judge Chazanow, after she determined that the Rich case required force in resisting arrest, what further information did she gain by using the modified approach to it? She's not looking for the facts, if I understand it. She's looking for the elements of the crime. And what did she find out?
Well, what she found out, Your Honor, was she used the incorporated statement of probable cause, which, as this court has held on numerous occasions, is a Shepard-approved document. So she looked to that, and she found out that that if there, which she said, there may be a resisting arrest variant that is non-forceful.
The recitation that, by police officers is, I have probable cause. Does that add anything to the element of the offense?
it doesn't add anything to the element, but what it does is it allows for the district court to make a determination as to...
Well, that's a factual determination, isn't it?
Well, it's a comparison of the facts that are included in the statement of probable cause, and it's a comparison of those to the two variants of resisting arrest that she said are possibly committed in Maryland, one involving violent force and one involving nonviolent force. So she came to the conclusion, which of course the government disagrees with, that it's possible in Maryland to commit a nonviolent resisting arrest.
Well, again, isn't that a factual determination rather than a legal determination?
Well, it's
based on the affidavit?
Your Honor, let me try to be as frank as I can. Facts are not a dirty word in this area of the law. It is absolutely a factual determination in the sense that she looked to the facts that are included in the statement of probable cause. And so, yes, she was looking at facts, but what Shepard and Taylor are all about is saying there is this small universe of documents that you can look to. But once you get into those documents, you can look at the facts. You can look at every single fact in those documents.
Well, then my question is, could the defendant have been convicted under the statute without the element of force?
No. The Rich Court says that you got to have force. And so then the question that's raised, and of course our brief, and
then are you determining the quantity of force that was applied?
And then you're looking to the on the categorical question, you're looking to, does the statute require violent force? And of course it's our position that it does, and you know, Romo v. Lobos in the 11th Circuit.
I understand that a mere touching would satisfy the Maryland statute.
Absolutely not. A mere touching, and we've got good language in Rich that says, you know, a mere touching or flight might be obstructing or hindering, but it's not resisting. Resisting requires violent force as determined by the Maryland courts. And we've got, you know, 38 opinions over 60 years, none of which involves something less than violent force. It's just not in the nature of the crime to commit it by something less than violent or strong physical force. But just if I might, I believe your Honor is interested in the modified categorical approach. And it's certainly our position that if the court were to decide that it's not categorical, categorically a crime of violence, or assume without deciding that it's not categorically a crime of violence, then you can go to the modified categorical approach. And there it was entirely appropriate for Judge Chazanow to look at this statement of probable cause, Shepard-approved document, and say, hey, this, that if there is such a thing as non-violent resisting arrest in the state of Maryland, this isn't it. This is a violent course of action that unfolded across two counties, involved sideswiping an innocent bystander, nearly sideswiping a patrol car, and you know, biting the hand of a Charles County sheriff.
As you probably know, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge Wilkins.
I wanted to get back to the question that Judge Davis asked early on, and that is because I think these two precedents that we have in Johnson and Warlick are crucial. And are there cases where a court has found a crime to be violent under the residual clause of the ACCA, but somehow nonviolent under the force clause?
I'm not aware of any. I'm certainly not aware of any in the narrow world of resisting arrest as it exists in various state codes across the country. And between myself and Ms. Merchandani, we probably would have found it if there were one that, as Judge Davis said, you know, explicitly contrasted those two in the context of a state statute. Now, there are, of course, crimes that are found to meet the residual clause of the ACCA, but not the force clause. But those are usually crimes like escape, which was the subject of the Supreme Court's opinion in Sykes. Crimes that are clearly not inherently forceful, but that do pose a risk of injury, or vehicular flight, those kinds of statutes where there is a finding under the residual clause, but the force clause is just never even analyzed because it's not an inherently forceful crime. So there are those types of crimes, but I'm not aware of any crime that requires force.
Does it make a difference that, I mean, I keep coming back. Doesn't it make a difference that the statutes and the guideline provisions are worded in terms of physical force?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They could use any number of adjectives, but they use the word physical force.
Absolutely. How do you reconcile that with Johnson?
Johnson is about not sweeping in this limited group of state assault and battery convictions that are predicated on offensive touchings. Resisting arrest has to involve more than an offensive touching. This is not about pinching or kissing someone on the cheek who doesn't want to be kissed. This is about pulling away and struggling with, physically struggling with an officer.
I do have one last quick question. You're probably aware, I'm sure, perhaps counsel for the defendant is not, that we've put on the shelf a number of cases pending the Supreme Court's decision in I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Is it DeChamps?
I've been saying DeCamps, but DeCamps. I could be wrong.
Okay, DeCamps. Is this a candidate for that treatment?
Well,
of course, by the time the Supreme Court decides, this guy is probably going to be deported, I suspect. But should we hold this case, in your opinion?
Well,
would that help us?
Let me.
I guess it wouldn't if we decide it's categorical.
That's right. So 2 points. One is, Your Honor, I believe that I didn't calculate or go on the prison website to determine Mr. Aparicio-Soria's release date, but it is sometime in 2014.
Oh, okay.
So there is room to run here, and I do think that I'm sure Ms. Merchandani would tell you that this is important and that the court should decide it, and it would matter to Mr. Aparicio-Soria's sentence. On the issue of DeCamp, if the court goes in a categorical direction and upholds the decision of Judge Chazanow because resisting arrest is categorically a crime of violence, then I don't think DeCamp is in play because that's a modified categorical case. If, however, the court goes in the modified categorical direction, then I think it probably would make sense to hold it for DeCamp. Thank you. I see I'm out of time.
I'd be pleased to hear from you in rebuttal.
I'll keep it very brief. We agree with the government that if this goes categorical, there's no need to wait. If it goes modified, then we should see what DeCamp says.
What is your view about holding it?
Well, we believe that the categorical approach applies and that it's never a crime of violence.
But the Supreme Court is deciding whether it's categorical it's going to decide this whole business of categorical.
Well, no, the Supreme Court is going to decide once you go to the modified whether or not you can supplant a missing element with proof of facts in the record.
How much surgery you can do on the statute.
Yes. How much of a scalpel you can take, exactly. But they're not going to address whether the categorical applies. They're just going to say, once you go modified, can this other thing be used? So
we could write this opinion only to find ourselves brought up short by something the Supreme Court says. It's certainly going to be in the area.
I encourage you to write it up quickly and to find it categorical, because the Supreme Court in DeCamp will say nothing that affects that. You don't need DeCamp for that.
Nothing we say is going to persuade the Supreme Court.
Well,
but something the Supreme Court says.
Well, the Gomez, to find the categorical approach applies here, all you need is Gomez and Johnson.
Well, Gomez, see, that's the problem. Gomez is, the viability of Gomez, I think, turns significantly on DeCamps.
You think so?
That's the truth of the matter.
Even though the statute was found?
I think so.
Divisible. Well, in that case, maybe
we're all waiting
you will.
With bated breath.
Okay, that's fine.
Or some of us are.
Just to correct
government,
a couple.
The government is saying you lose under either approach.
I think we win under either approach. But just to correct a couple of statements that the government made, just as a factual matter. Excuse me. They said that Maryland law, the resisting arrest, the force has to be applied to another person. That is absolutely not true. We know in I can't believe it, remember if it's Nicholas or Rich, but the force can be applied to an object, which is why I gave the tree hugging analogy. The government in that case, actually the state, argued that the force of slamming a door in the face of an officer was enough physical force to constitute resisting arrest. Okay, the second thing I want to correct.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
One of the things that interests me is, the categorical approach tells. The modified categorical approach says what records a district court is the maximum allowable universe of records that a district court can consult in terms of applying predicate offense used to determine a guideline range or an ACCA sentence. But suppose the case goes back on remand, And Judge Eisenhower, after DeCamps or whatever, Judge Eisenhower says, well, you know, I'm no longer applying predicate crimes, but federal law imposes no limitations on what I can consult in the course of sentencing. And I have a very good idea what this is. I know what the activity, what this individual did with a car chase, hitting innocent pedestrians, biting police officers. And I'm going to use this not in terms of a predicate crime ACCA sentence or predicate crime of violence. I'm going to use it for an upward variance.
That would be perfectly fine. Under 3553A, the court could consider that and say, I think you're an inherently violent person based on these charges. I want to give you an upward variance. That's fine. But that is very different than saying that it satisfies the force clause. And if I could just make the second correction
to
the
second point?
Government. The government said that that Nicholas says that violent force is necessary. It's the opposite. De minimis force is necessary. The government said that more than offensive touching is necessary. Again, not. I want to refer you to the reply brief at pages 4-6. There are cases listed there where only de minimis force was used. So unless you have any other questions.
By the way, when you said to Judge Wilkinson that would be fine, you weren't speaking for your colleague who'll be standing in front of Judge Chasnow representing the defendant if there's a resentencing, right?
That's right. It's not me who does that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll come down and we'll proceed right into our next case.